You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, tens of thousands more tech employees are out of a job after Microsoft and Amazon start to downsize today. As employers reduce headcount, is the pandemic's moment of worker empowerment over?
And universities in Texas are taking action against TikTok, with Texas A&M and Texas University reportedly blocking the app from its Wi-Fi networks as part of the governor's orders. Could this be the start of a greater trend?
And do you want one of Twitter's offices' neon signs? Or a whiteboard? Or a giant refrigerator? Twitter has resorted to auctioning office items. We'll show you what was up for grabs. But first, we want to talk about one of the key issues that layoffs sometimes bring, certainly for, well, plenty of chief technology and chief security officers, because there are security concerns around all of this. Disgruntled workers, for example, maybe they take corporate secrets with them when they get laid off, or maybe they get a bit careless about them. Bloomberg's Margie Murphy has a great story on all of this. And just tell us a little bit, Margie, about how companies are starting to prepare themselves as they know they're going to make layoffs. How do they ensure that the data that they have remains secure?
Yeah, it's a real problem because around the time that layoffs are happening, obviously everyone's trying to tighten their belt, and that's when security budgets might be cut a little bit. But companies are looking at things like new software that's around to track whether employees are using data exfiltration methods. And they're also trying really hard to just give out the messaging and reminding people that the things that they're working on belong to the company, not to themselves. I mentioned data exfiltration, and that's when people forward emails to their personal accounts or maybe copy and paste a spreadsheet with contact details or client contracts. And that puts companies at risk of obviously losing business if that person takes that with them to another company, but also regulatory and confidentiality issues as well.
Margie, we've got to ask ourselves why we're discussing this story. Fantastic work in Business Week magazine and an analysis of what happens when we hear about jobs being cut, layoffs in the technology industry to the tunes of thousands. The kind of the anecdote that you guys use is Coinbase, right, when it announced its layoffs, and Brian Armstrong basically explaining that by the end of the day, employees would receive notifications to their personal email addresses, and it was very abrupt. And he said, look, we kind of have to do this because our customer information is key. We have to protect that customer data. What kind of serious steps have you reported on that companies are taking to kind of safeguard themselves and their customers when they go through a round of layoffs like this?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, the case with Coinbase, it was, you know, employees were waking up to already having their email shut off, which sounds incredibly callous and was criticized, you know, for kind of lacking that personal touch to realize that you've been completely wiped from a company. But more and more companies are having to do this because the risk is just so high. It's so easy for employees to just simply forward an email. You know, if they've got a few hours left, they'll just be kind of sending stuff to their own personal Gmails. And not you know, you've got some people who are obviously irritated that they're fired and maybe want to do something really kind of bad with that and leak it. But often people don't even realize that what they're doing is against their employment contract, and they simply want to kind of better themselves and their next employment because they're scared. They've just been let go. But largely, we're seeing companies just really crack down and shut down from the minute people are being laid off, and being very, very cold, I guess, but extremely secure, just because the risks are so high. We've seen issues with Coinbase. You know, it had that an employee was accused of insider trading because they were sharing some information. There was the famous case with Waymo, which was Google's driverless. Right. Car arm, Anthony Lewandowski. He famously kind of went to Uber, sort of defected, and he took company secrets with him, and it was an extremely long court case and had serious ramifications for Google. So the stakes are really, really high.
All right, Bloomberg, Margie Murphy, just terrific reporting on air and also in Business Week. Check out that story on Bloomberg.com. Now, as we've been discussing, Amazon and Microsoft are laying off some of their workforce. This is part of a wider wave of job cuts that are hitting the tech industry right now, already facing, of course, the chance of recession globally. Here's what some of our guests across Bloomberg Television have been talking about.
We've not been positive on big tech for, I don't know, a year, year and a half.
We do believe that 2023, there is still some deflation to come out of this market after the exuberance of 2021.
I actually think that the tech sector is one of the few sectors that is really discounting a recession in its outlook.
The longer the macro volatility persists, we do expect early stage and seed to start to see that crunch that the late stage is seeing right now.
There is going to be some amount of normalization of that demand. Quite frankly, we in the tech industry will also have to get efficient, right? It's not about everyone else doing more with less. We will have to do more with less.
All right, so let's bring in Bloomberg's Austin Carr, who's been writing about why behind the job cuts. And you heard there, Austin, from a broad range of names across venture capital, public markets, also Satya Nadella, on why we're seeing these layoffs in the technology industry. Wrap all of this together, because you've been writing about this also in Business Week.
So what we saw over the last year or two is just, as one of those analysts had noticed, this exuberance coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, where the tech sector, more than any other industry, had really bet big on this new revenue acceleration being permanent. And we've seen that course correction happen quite harshly in more recent days and months, with Amazon and Microsoft announcing sort of headline-grabbing layoffs in the 10,000-18,000 range figures. And what's totally remarkable about that is how it compares to the rest of the U.S. economy. Job cuts in 2022 were actually up in the tech sector 649% compared to the previous year, whereas in the rest of the economy, the layoffs were only up 13%. So what you saw is all these tech companies betting huge on that COVID-era growth remaining and being a much longer-term phenomenon. And we're now seeing a sort of big course correction from all the big tech companies.
And it really is trying to understand, firstly, whether it's a bellwether, but Austin, also why it's not really showing up in the big data at the moment. Many hypothesize that these people are highly talented, highly skilled, and people still want them in the other industries. So they're snapped up very quickly rather than showing up in the BLS data, for example. But go to also where they might add jobs, because I thought that was interesting from Satya Nadella and Amazon and Microsoft at large. They are still going to be hiring in some spaces, right?
Well, that's the narrative that they sold Wall Street on, this sort of high growth, high risk, big return investment. So they can't just stop all of those moonshots that they've been investing in for the last couple of years and let go of that very high caliber, expensive engineering talent. So you're seeing sort of this balance between tech companies trying to give off some signal that they're going to be a little bit more financially prudent and conservative while not giving up on some of those longer term bets. With Microsoft, for example, Satya Nadella saying, we're going to double down on core businesses, but we're going to continue to invest in high growth areas like AI. Or with Amazon, they're seeing layoffs happen in the retail division or in some of their devices, sort of the riskier hardware bets that they've been making with Alexa devices. But at the same time, he's also saying, Andy Jassy, the CEO, has said, we're still going to invest in high growth areas like groceries or B2B services, third-party seller markets. So they're really trying to sort of balance that sort of risk and reward right now.
I want to bring up this terminal chart again, which we showed earlier in the show. Amazon's total global headcount, right? So 18,000 jobs. It's a striking headline, but it's 1% of its global workforce. And I think there's some discussion about this from market participants in our reporting, right, Austin? What does that tell us, the difference between the headlines and the reality, and how this period, this economy of 2023, might be different to the dot-com bubble, even the 2008 financial crisis?
Yeah, it indicates so far that just given how wired big tech is into the rest of the global economy, it's a lot different than it was during the dot-com crash 2 decades ago. All these companies around the world are much more dependent on Silicon Valley software, their hardware, their chips, their cloud computing services, their enterprise services as well. So it's not the case that as much as these headline-grabbing numbers are pretty massive, they're still a small percentage of Amazon's overall workforce. Or for Microsoft, the 10,000 cuts that they announced, that's I think only 5% of their overall workforce. So it's a lot smaller, and it's also in specific areas, at least from our sources, we're hearing from HR and recruiting, rather than some of the high caliber, expensive talent in engineering that sort of can double down for their core businesses that they want to continue invest in. But again, it's always that balance. With Mark Zuckerberg, he said, you know what, we're still going to invest more, we're going to reprioritize our ad business, but we're still going to make that bet in engineering talent in our metaverse, which is that longer term bet that they're making.
It's nuanced, and you do it so well for us, Austin. Thank you very much indeed, Austin Carr. It's a great read. Meanwhile, well, one sector in technology that's really been letting go of a lot of staff is crypto. And in fact, crypto firm Genesis is one of those. And it's also said it's preparing now, we understand, for bankruptcy filing as early as this week. The lending unit of Barry Silbert's digital currency group, Genesis, is in confidential negotiations with various creditor groups amid a liquidity crunch. Genesis suspended withdrawals in November, soon after FTX went bankrupt, of course. On Tuesday, Digital Currency Group told shareholders that it's suspending quarterly dividends in an effort to conserve cash. Coming up, well, no more access to TikTok at universities in Texas. What impact could that ban have? We'll discuss. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I think the national security issue of our time is the technology competition with China. We've already seen that around things like 5G, semiconductors. We're now looking at issues like new energy and synthetic biology, because in China, we have a competitor that's investing at a rate that's commensurate with what we're investing. And I'm all for innovation, but I've been particularly concerned about TikTok. My fear is, one, TikTok collects more information about you as a user than virtually any other site around. Your keystrokes, your facial expressions, and I'm horribly afraid that that's being stored somewhere in Beijing. I'm also concerned about it being an ability to manipulate the flow of information to you.
That was Senator Mark Warner there. And look, speaking of TikTok, some universities in Texas, like the University of North Texas, among others, they're said to be blocking access to the video sharing app TikTok on its Wi-Fi and wired networks to comply with, quote, Governor Abbott's directive to all state agencies banning employees from using or downloading TikTok on all state-issued or managed devices and environments. This according to a statement shared with Bloomberg. Now, Bloomberg's Alex Barinka is here to break it all down. And what's so interesting to me, Alex, is basically the university's front-running the rest of the state. Oh, I think we've got a technical glitch. We're going to be getting to Alex in a moment, who's out in LA. But Ed, first let's bring in what our audience said, because yes, it seems as though we're seeing a front-running in certain institutions in a state versus the state itself and states themselves front-running the federal government. Right. But we asked ultimately our audience as to whether this is going to make any difference. And well, many seem to think VPNs are going to come to the rescue in some way.
Yeah, look, there's two sides to this debate, right? In Texas, what you see is universities, essentially public entities, enacting the directive from the governor and putting that into practice. And that manifests itself by the universities not allowing students or anyone on campus to access the TikTok app through the Wi-Fi network. Yeah. Well, they can probably still access it if they turn off Wi-Fi and use their 5G network. But it's the debate around who should be acting on this, because the Biden administration and the federal government have been leading a security review of TikTok and other cybersecurity threats for some time. And there's the answer, right, Caro? 48% of the respondents we polled said this isn't going to fix anything. Ban the specifics of not allowing TikTok access on campus in Texas universities. But they are following through in the governor's directive.
They are. And let's get to Alex now. I think technology issues solved on this technology show. Tell us, Alex, about whether you're surprised that some of these institutions are going headlong into these sorts of bans.
It is a little interesting how they're interpreting this, right? They actually, University of Texas at Austin, for example, doesn't have a specific directive to move forward in this way. Texas Tech is waiting until they get more guidance from the state. So it's interesting to see Texas, Georgia, Alabama really being front-footed here and following along what we heard at the top from Senator Warner, basically saying we're worried about data sharing on TikTok and potential data sharing with the Chinese government, and we're going to lock this down. Now, Ed, what you said about students potentially looking for workarounds, accessing TikTok on their cellular data and not on the Wi-Fi where it's banned, that's exactly what's happening. I've been chatting to folks who are on the ground at UT Austin in particular who have said, look, we have other ways we're going to access this app. I use it for entertainment. I use it for educational content. So they're on TikTok anyways, even if it's not on the Wi-Fi at the university.
Yeah, quite. I think it's also an educational issue, right? Understanding why is this a security risk and conveying that to users of all social media platforms. That seems to be what we're hearing from users of that particular platform. Bloomberg's Alex Barinka, thank you very much. Now, Cisco CEO Chuck Robbins spoke to Bloomberg's David Weston in Davos about tech layoffs, the impact of COVID-19 on the tech sector, but first about their investment into software. Have a listen.
Well, there's a few things we've done. We've added a lot of our cybersecurity technology is just pure software, right? I mean, that's just the nature of the industry and how we're defending against threats. Collaboration is a lot of software, our WebEx portfolio and the meetings capability. So those are just natural software products. We've then also begun to sell subscriptions on our hardware platforms. And that's been a transition we started back in 2017 or 18. And last quarter, recurring revenue, including software and services, represented 43% of our business, which is significantly different than where we were five, six, 7 years ago.
You mentioned earlier the pandemic and what that did in tech. How did it change your business? And maybe over the longer term, maybe not just over the short term, but were there fundamental shifts in the use of technology that affects Cisco?
Well, I think it became clear I really believe that prior to the pandemic, every executive believed technology was strategic, right? We, a decade or 15 years ago, we moved from it being an operational productivity driver to really being a strategic enabler and a strategic differentiator for our customers. During the pandemic, it just elevated. I mean, everyone's eyes were open as to, we kept the world running when everyone was at home. We kept everyone productive, and I think no one believed that was possible, including a lot of people in tech. And we'd never tried it before, so doing it at that scale. And I think what that did is it gave our customers this incredible confidence in investing in technology and listening to their teams who are bringing them these new crazy creative projects around what they want to do with technology. And they go, well, I've seen it work here, so I'm going to trust you and believe you. So I think that's one piece of it. And then I think from a cultural perspective, I think every company's culture was magnified during the pandemic. And I think that we'll never go back to the way we were. I think we're going to operate in environments where employees want to have human, authentic conversations, just like we did over video while everybody was at home. And so I think it changed how we engage with our employees as well.
Talking about new crazy creative projects in tech, there's a lot of talk around here about open AI, artificial intelligence, and by the way, quantum computing. I'm not sure exactly what those mean, but there's a lot of talk about them. Is that going to fundamentally change your business?
Well, we're working on quantum networking today, because when you have big networks of quantum computers, you have to be able to connect them and actually move the bits at rates that are commensurate with the speed of the computers. So there's a lot of research that we're engaged in right now. So we're in the early days. We have a team of people doing research on quantum networking. So absolutely, that'll be a part of our business. And then these OpenAI and things like ChatGPT, and then that's something that I actually had a conversation with my team about. And I think it's amazing how fast it went from sort of being exposed to all of a sudden, my guess is my next board meeting, we'll have a conversation about ChatGPT and OpenAI. And we think there's lots of great use cases that we can leverage that technology for. And there's also a lot of probably some understood and some not understood unintended consequences from that technology.
Do you think it could be fundamentally disruptive?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt.
Want to own a piece of Silicon Valley history? Maybe you now do, because Twitter was auctioning off its old office supplies. Get this, 631 lots were on offer, and some of them went for tens of thousands of dollars. For example, a blue neon light, the Twitter bird itself, maybe an at sign that was a planter, all of these going for big bucks. The auction house behind it says that this isn't actually to secure the financing of Twitter itself, although we do know it's in a relatively precarious situation, needs to be paying down debt. And Elon Musk himself is, well, not paying some of the rents over in San Francisco. But for now, the auction is done, and maybe you now have a piece of corporate history.
I checked it out because I think it stopped, the auction, 27 hours long, finished at 10 a.m. Pacific time, your time, Ed.
Right.
32,000 there or thereabouts for that neon sign. This is kind of trophy stuff, particularly if you work there.
So I love that you focused on kind of more glitzy, shiny items. What I loved was just the endless thumbnails showing tables and chairs. And if you really wanted, you could buy a full office set to furnish your office from Twitter HQ. I actually know a guy who's been in that building a few times. Bloomberg News' Kurt Wagner, who joins us now, because on top of that news, the report by The Information that Twitter's revenue dropped as much as 35% last quarter from the same period a year ago. Gosh, Twitter, you and I, we've had a rough 2022 navigating this. Let's start with the financials, and we'll get to the furniture.
Yep.
A drop in revenue, as reported by The Information. I mean, what's happening, in short?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this for a while, right, which is that 90% roughly of Twitter's revenue comes from advertising. And if you're an advertiser right now, Twitter is a sort of a scary place. It's not a comfortable, a safe environment to be spending your money. And so I don't think any of us are shocked. We've seen the headlines and news about a lot of these big advertisers who have stepped back from Twitter. And so the reality that this hit them very hard, especially in the fourth quarter, when, you know, a lot of the marketing budgets usually come about, is not a super big surprise to me.
Kurt, how is Twitter in chief dealing with all of this? Because many had sort of commented that the tweets coming from Elon Musk have got a little less, well, controversial, shall we say, of late. But how is he trying to ensure that people are coming back to the platform, wanting to advertise with him?
Yeah. It does seem like he has sort of maybe redirected some of his attention, right? And perhaps that means to Tesla. Obviously, at the end of the year, beginning of this year, there was a lot of frustration from Tesla investors that he was not paying closer attention to the company. And so this may just be simply that, you know, he got there, he did a lot of the budget cuts that he was planned, the layoffs that were planned, and now he feels like he can sort of redirect attention elsewhere, right? But I think, like, bringing people back, unfortunately, that just takes time and it takes trust if you're an advertiser. And I'm not sure that Twitter has really earned the trust back from those big brand marketers. And it's probably the kind of thing that will take a while, and they'll have to watch and say, like, is Elon just taking a couple weeks off of tweeting controversial things, or is this the new normal for him moving forward? And I don't think we can say that just yet.
I want to dig deep into financials. I want to talk about the world's second richest man and how he's going to bring advertisers back. But I'm not going to ask you about that.
You want to know about the chairs?
Yeah.
The office chairs.
I want to know about this auction. What caught your eye? Did you buy anything? Or?
I didn't buy anything. Maybe a high top table. You and Caroline can come over for dinner sometime. that would be quite fun. But no, I mean, like, it's sad, right? It is.
There is a serious point behind this, which is that many people lost their jobs. That building was once full.
It makes sense from a logistics standpoint, right? If you are Twitter, you used to have close to 7,500, 8,000 employees, and you now have, you know, 25 or 30% of that, you don't need all of this office space. You don't need all of this office furniture. You don't need 500 whiteboards or 500 standing desks or whatever it may be, right? So it makes sense that they would get rid of this. But I think, you know, what a lot of people are seeing, right, is sort of like a yard sale from this company that had for a long time, like, a very visible culture, probably more than most tech companies, right, with the at symbol or the big neon bird. Like, these are the things we would see pictures of at, like, the office holiday party or whatever, right? So I just feel like maybe there's a little bit more kind of connection to Twitter's culture than most companies, just because so much of it plays out on the service itself.
So looking at the stats, the bird statue went for $100,000 in the auction,
right.
But Heritage Global Partners, who was behind the auction, kept saying, look, this isn't for the finances. Why do it then, and why do it so publicly?
Well, I think to do it is again, sort of like a space thing, right? Like, if you're really getting rid of offices in the way that we've seen Twitter get rid of, close the Seattle office. I think there was a Singapore office that they closed last week as well. Like, you got to do something with all the stuff that's in those offices, right? There's a logistics part of this where they no longer have the space to hold it. So I think that's probably part of it. Now, doing it publicly, I guess, how are you going to get the most bang for your buck, right? You have to make sure people know to go and bid on this thing. So I'm sort of speculating here, right? Because we haven't heard Elon say, here's the strategy behind the auction. But my guess would be that that's why they want to do it the way that they've been doing it.
All right. Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner covering every twist and turn inside and outside of Twitter. Thank you so much. I actually want to turn to the latest on Apple, because another day, another scoop. And it's taking on Amazon and Google, according to sources, by expanding their in-home product lineup. Meanwhile, Apple still planning to unveil its first mixed reality headset this year, but the plans for a lightweight augmented reality glasses have been postponed, sources say, due to technical challenges. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman broke both of those stories in the space of a single working day. And I'm delighted to say he joins Caroline and I now. Let's start with the in-home devices, because actually when I was at CES in Vegas recently, that was a big theme for many of the consumer electronics companies. What are the details you've reported?
So actually this morning, Apple rolled out a new HomePod, right? It's basically the return of the original HomePod. It's a bit lower cost because they've rolled it out at $300 instead of the original $350 of the HomePod. There's fewer microphones and tweeters inside the device, so not as powerful as the previous one. And it uses an Apple Watch processor instead of an iPhone processor. So you have a little bit of a shift there. But for audio fans, you're really not getting better than an Apple HomePod, the big one at $300 in your home. So I know a lot of people are looking forward to that product. Now they're working on a few other devices. They're working on a faster Apple TV for next year, though it won't have 8K functionality. And they're also working on a new low-end iPad for the home, smart home appliances, using it to FaceTime, using it to watch some video. So that's the smart home strategy for Apple moving forward.
Away from smart home to AR, VR, just tell us a little bit about the strategy there, because it looks as though they're struggling with the glasses at least.
So Apple's been developing its AR, VR strategy for north of 6 years, 7 years, 8 years at this point. And for a long time, the strategy was twofold. We're first going to roll out this high-end Halo device that's going to be a mixed reality headset merging virtual reality and augmented reality. A very complex, expensive $3,000 device that will cast a shadow over the AR/VR market. And then, as early as a year later, we would roll out glasses. These are lightweight AR-only glasses. That plan has changed. The mixed reality headset, the high-end one, the Reality Pro, that's still coming this year. But instead of a follow-up product being the AR glasses, the successive product is going to be a new low-end version of the mixed reality headset. So one that's probably about half the price, somewhere closer to $1,500, the same price as the high-end Meta Quest Pro headset. Now, the bigger news, those AR glasses, those are not coming anytime soon. Those have been pushed back indefinitely. Lots of technical challenges, lots of difficulty, right? The big headset's gonna have about 2 hours of battery life. The AR glasses are something you need to wear all day without needing to recharge them until nighttime, like a phone or an Apple Watch. If the high-end device is getting 2 hours, how could a device with even less space for components inside be worn all day? There's also challenges related to the displays, right? That's called a waveguide technology, to be able to see things in front of you while also being able to glean information off of displays. They'll have to be connected to cellular radios and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth at all times. So much complexity in that product. So it's going to be many years before we see augmented reality glasses from Apple.
Expertly analyzed for us, Mark Gurman. Thank you, as always. We'll let you get back to your scoop getting. Meanwhile, coming up, Netflix picks up steam ahead of its earnings. All important for tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Netflix earnings, as usual, will focus on the company's new subscriber count. Every quarter, it's that way. Investors always thinking subscriber growth. Did it go up? Did it go down? But this time around, they'll also be looking to initiatives to increase revenue. And of course, all the rage in the world of streaming is ad-supported tiers, which Netflix launched in November. Matt Spiegel, Executive Vice President of the Media and Entertainment Vertical at TransUnion, joins us. It's that interesting dynamic. We are obsessed with subscriber growth at all streaming platforms, but particularly Netflix. Yet this quarter, we're going to ask ourselves, how successful has Netflix been in attracting US customers in particular to an ad-supported tier? Is that the focus for you?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It certainly is. And I quite frankly think it's going to be a challenge. But that's ultimately because they're a victim of their own success. you look at how big Netflix is in the U.S., they really have more subscribers than really any of the streaming players in the country. And so really the hard part is, how do you get that penetration to shift to ad dollars or to an ad experience? And the likely reality is most of us who have Netflix accounts aren't going to do that. And so my guess is, over the short term, it's going to take a little while for them to get to the numbers they expect on the ad model. I think over the long term, they'll be fine. But, you know, if I'd make a prediction of what we'll hear tomorrow, my guess is less ad users than they might have ultimately hoped for, but will build over time.
I actually have some sympathy to Netflix, so I know have frustrations about how micro-focused we are. Consensus is for new subscriber additions of around 4.5 million. But Karen and I have talked about this in the past. There's a whole generation of user out there, many of them young people, who have never seen ads. They grew up where they could stream whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, ad-free. And I wonder if that is a big factor here, not just for Netflix, for Disney, the attractiveness of an ad-supported product. Many people just don't want it.
Yeah, listen, that's fair. Certainly no consumer says they want ads. But if you look at really what happens in the entirety of the media ecosystem, there's always a balance there. The practical reality is, we as consumers can only spend money on so many things to really subscribe to. And we're really willing to actually exchange our time in exchange for really subsidizing that experience. Think about certainly the cable experience and the linear experience, while much less prevalent than it was, there are still times we do that. And so I don't think we have a question of whether advertising is part of the ecosystem or not. You really have, you've got premium content creators, Netflix being one of them, which is always going to look for an opportunity to make additional revenue. And by the way, very highly accretive revenue when it scales in the form of advertising. Yeah. So that balance between subscribers and advertising, I don't think is going anywhere. And sure, many consumers won't always want advertising, but my guess is you'll always find a market somewhere.
One of those markets. I mean, the only time I want advertising is when I'm watching the Super Bowl, right? So Matt, to that end, what about sport? What about live events? Is that, how are we going to see the actual product and some of the content they provide iterate over at Netflix?
Listen, I think that's exactly right. What we're really talking about is Netflix becoming a media company much like the others, right? Different from a streaming content company that was all about subs. You're now talking about having to attract the type of eyeballs at one time in scale to balance that ad model. And you're right. You're seeing them already invest in, or reportedly invest in, the opportunity to take sports rights. And I think that will be something they'll continue to do. You've clearly seen that work well with an Amazon Prime. And ultimately, if you want to be in the media business, inclusive of advertising, you need to have those quote water cooler moments. It's not only sports, but it is clearly heavily dominated by sports these days. Those live moments really do matter. And that's really what all the media companies are finding, that right balance, right? The linear model clearly is shifting. It's not going to die for a while. Streaming will be the dominant form of distribution though, as time goes on. But that can be on demand. It can still be what really feels like a linear TV ad business, just in a streaming environment, which is things like live sports. And balancing all those things is going to be what companies like Netflix have to do to compete. Listen, they are absolutely in competition for against the Disneys and the Warner Brothers of the world, and that's part of the ecosystem.
And kind of, I wonder what sets them apart from some of their competitors is that they get they've got technology in their bones. They are a group of engineers. They're sort of a tech first, but also media player. And I'm interested as to whether that sets them apart. Can they win the personalization race if perhaps they're all pulling back on content spend now?
Yeah, I think that's going to have to be part of it. Certainly there are other companies that have good technology as well, but Netflix, to your point, has that at their bones. I think that's going to impact not only their content strategy, but also their ad strategy. You really got to give them credit for how they've approached the ad business so far. Some really great, you know, senior hires in that team, a partnership with Microsoft, which makes a ton of sense. And so while we're certainly going to, like I said, I expect over the short term, it's going to be a harder ramp for Netflix to get to the point where their ad business is as scaled as they hope. But having that DNA, which is part content, part technology, I agree, can only help. You know, certainly the ad business is one where the mix of scale and precision matters, right? Advertisers are absolutely looking for that balance. And a Netflix who can hopefully invent in the right ways to provide both a scaled audience, but doing that in a real targeted way with interesting new ad creative, which again, let's be clear, this is going to take time. It will be an evolutionary process, but there's a lot to be excited about for Netflix over the long term.
Matt Spiegel, great to have you on. That look ahead to the earnings, Executive Vice President at TransUnion. Meanwhile, let's pivot back to Switzerland, the Alps to Davos, because HCL Tech, the software giant, and it's based in India, is coming over to talk about how they're focusing on ESG, on non-linear growth in the long term. Bloomberg's Haslinda Amin discussed the company's priorities with the HCL Tech chairperson, that's Roshni Malhotra.
So I think, we've got five strategic objectives. The first one being we are an IT services group and we cover digital engineering, cloud, as well as software. So we want to be able to lead with differentiated products and services. We want to be able to be a preferred digital partner for global 2000 companies in preferred geographies. Weaving ESG into a lot of the business strategy is absolutely critical for us. HCL Technologies hires 225,000 people across the world, and the average age is 27 and below. So I think today, the strategic priority for a company has to be a preferred employer. And then lastly, I think if we're able to meet these strategic objectives, then delivering the highest shareholder return in medium to term, it should be the ultimate strategic direction.
There's so much uncertainty.
Yeah.
There's so much disruption.
Yeah.
What's your strategy to stay relevant?
So I think, like I said, I think one part of it is technology.
But and what's the growth strategy?
I think the growth strategy is investing in our people and investing in skills. Like I said, we've got 225,000 people all over the world. Technology is moving a lot faster than the skills can keep up. We do about 2 million to 3 million hours of training a quarter, and that is only going to grow. We also have to find non-linear ways of growth. So if you look at our software portfolio, which is quite unique to HCL Technologies, it's about 2 billion of our 12 billion revenue. It's much more non-linear. So while the balance 10 billion would have more than 150,000 people working on it, our 2 billion in software will have about 5,000.
You talk about being a $12 billion company.
Yes.
How do you take it to 30? How do you take it to 50? When can you get there?
I don't know when we are going to get there. I think I can only talk about our strategic vision in the next 5 to 7 years. But the investment that we made in HCL Software, which is a $2 billion that we get from 5,000 engineers, is a non-linear growth. And I think that as we go forward, we are going to want to grow that business as well.
Indian IT executives lament that there is a gap between engineering education and what the industries actually need. How do you bridge that gap, especially now that you're part of the, MIT's dean of...
The Global Advisory Council.
The Global Advisory Council. Thank you.
So, there are a couple of experiments that we're doing in HCLI. Of course, talked about investing in a lot of training, which closes the gap between fresh engineers and what they need to do to deliver to customers all over the world. We're also doing something very interesting, which is we've got 8,000 fresh school graduates in the HCL system. And we've partnered with universities so that on the weekends they can pursue an undergraduate education. But Monday to Friday, these are 18-year-olds, they're digital natives. We got them from grade 12. We've got 50% women, young women, as part of this cohort. And after 8 to 9 months of training, they're ready to deliver. So it's also looking at alternate talent pools. And as you go forward in the world, you're going to realize that there are more people who don't pursue higher education than those who actually do, because higher education is becoming prohibitively expensive. So how do we actually tap into different talent pools? And so I think that's quite unique to HCL Tech.
Going viral today, what was the fear of opening your bank account to see a negative balance? Dozens of Bank of America customers using the transaction service Zelle, they were tweeting about how their funds suddenly disappeared overnight, or that they had trouble logging into the banking app at all. Now, the website Down Detector had hundreds of reports that there were issues with Zelle. Take a look at this chart. An app similar, of course, to Venmo, built by a group of U.S.'s biggest banks like Bank of America. Those reports, they seem to have died down by Wednesday afternoon. Now, according to American banker, Zelle runs more than $1.6 billion in transactions daily. This is heavily lent upon, Ed, overall. I know that I use it. I know that many person use it. And to log on and to see negative, I'm also freaked out.
Yeah, I mean, them saying PSA, I guess, 3 p.m. Eastern, this was resolved. But, you know, if Instagram goes down, Twitter goes down, whatever, your bank account goes down and then shows missing funds, that's different. And seeing social media response, savage.
Yeah, I have to say, some of the memes are pretty great. Go and check them out on Twitter or on Instagram. Meanwhile, that does it from this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Thursday, we'll share new data about crypto launderings from Chainalysis.
Don't forget the podcast.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.